Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is December 5th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here for the first of multiple installments of Hitler and Communism. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh, the God of white European Israel.
And when
how are we doing today?
Off on the Hitler series about maybe a year ago, we showed that Hitler was a practicing, believing, sincere Christian who, while not having, say, the same knowledge as Comparé, Swift, or identity people of today, was a lot better off than most of the preachers of his time. He knew a lot more about who the Jews were and who his people were.
Well, absolutely. That, there's no doubt.
And then we spent most of the last year showing how Bolshevism was on the rise, how it came about, how it spread, it tried to spread into Spain, how it threatened Germany from Poland, Czechoslovakia, how the Jews were at the forefront of all the revolutions of the 1700s and 1800s, and how Germany was basically besieged.
Well, absolutely. And we saw from Wilhelm Marr, who was writing in 1879, that he thought that Germany was already lost to Judaism, that the Jews had subsumed Germany, and because the Jews act as a tribe, and Germans typically don't, right? That they have no sense of kin and family. And that's our biggest fault as a race, is not sticking together. Where the Jews as a race are like a thousand ticks on a deer, right? That they all act in harmony to suck every ounce of blood out of the deer. That's the way the Jews are. We saw in the pages of Nestor Webster that internationalism was a Jewish agenda from the very beginning. International socialism and international or global capitalism are trumpeted as polar opposites, yet they are both products of the same Jew, and they work in concert to destroy white Christian society and basically all civilized nations. Here we shall see that Adolf Hitler esteemed them to be one and the same, and that Hitler knew much more about the Jew than most modern people know today, because most modern people are still deceived by the Jew.
Absolutely, and I wanted to say, as far as unity goes, the Jews, when you attack one of them or challenge one, Jews that have never even dealt with that particular Jew, who don't know anything about him other than that he's a Jew, will come to his aid and defense, and they'll attack you. Where white people, they can be the white guy down the street who they know, and they won't come to his defense.
Absolutely not. It's the biggest fault of our race. I'd like to read two paragraphs, first from Kurt Wiebe, right? It's a short one.
All right.
Racial predisposition. This is from Kurt Wiebe, Dr. Kurt Wiebe, Germany and the Jewish Problem. Racial predisposition and historical destiny combine to incline the Jews to certain categories of activity whose sphere of influence is, by their very nature, international. It is consequently explicable that during the era of emancipation, meaning the early 19th century, right, the Jews should have successfully sought to obtain control of A, public opinion, B, the stock and share markets, C, wholesale and retail trade, D, certain influential cultural organizations, and last but not least, E, political life. And that's what they do everywhere they go. They claim to be 3% of the population wherever they are, and they end up controlling the whole nation because they always act in concert with each other, and we never do. And they always take a care and gain wealth in order to control people, and we don't gain wealth for those reasons. To continue to Wiebe, at the close of the emancipation era in Germany, the Jews enjoyed a practical monopoly of all the professions exerting intellectual and political influence. We see that in America today. This enabled them to stamp their entirely alien features on the whole public life of the country. And that is exactly what Wilhelm Marr testified to in very different words. Quotes about from quotes about Jews by Jews, which I have a copy of it. It's in many places on the internet, right? But I have a copy of it at mk.christogenia.org, the Mein Kampf site. You cannot be English Jews. We, and this is the words of Gerald Soman, we are a race, and only as a race can we perpetuate. Our mentality is of a Hebraic, and we know that to be a lie, right? It's really of a Canaanite character, and differs from that of an Englishman. Of course, we would agree to that. Enough subterfuge. Let us assert openly that we are international Jews. Gerald Soman, chairman of the World Jewry Fellowship, and its official manifesto, January 1st, 1935. So we have Kurt Wiebe and Gerald Soman, a Jew, in total agreement on the nature of the Jew, right?
Well, that sounds like right out of Russia number one, when the foreign minister said that it is organized and spread by Jews who have no nationality and whose one purpose is to overthrow for their own agenda the existing order of things, that how they were going to spread socialism across the world because Jews have no loyalty to their respective nations, only international Jewry.
Well, absolutely, and let me say in my own words that the Jew is an international creature because he never had a nation of his own, ever. It is certain that not even was Judea a Jewish nation. Judea was a white nation that those now known as Jews had subverted back from the time of the 2nd century B.C. They stole its heritage, and they mingled it with their own, and their own heritage is really found in the Talmud and not in the Bible. The pattern is fully evident. They have done the same thing with England and France in the 18th and 19th centuries, with Germany in the 19th century, and with America in the 20th century. The Jew is international because he knows that none of those nations are really his own. Yet, he claims them all as his own. The Talmud says that he should possess them all, and the Jew believes it. The only real problem is that we, non-Jews, do not believe that the Jew believes it, and in most cases, we do not even know of it. So the progress of the Jew in subjugating all nations moves forward virtually unhindered.
And about what Hitler said in regards to their scheming machinations and their incessant cry for Palestine back in the 20s and 30s, how they wanted an ethnic Jewish state, on page 184, he said, "The Jewish domination of the state seems now so fully assured that not only can he afford to call himself a Jew once again, but he even acknowledges freely and openly what his ideas are on racial and political questions. A section of the Jews avows itself quite openly as an alien people, but even here there is another falsehood. When the Zionists try to make the rest of the world believe that the new national consciousness of the Jews will be satisfied by the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, the Jews thereby adopt another means to dupe the simple-minded Gentile. They have not the slightest intention of building up a Jewish state in Palestine so as to live in it, and history has shown that to be true. What they're
absolutely
looking at is to establish a central organization for their international swindling and cheating. As a sovereign state, this cannot be controlled by any of the other states. Therefore, it can serve as a refuge for swindlers who have been found out, and at the same time a high school for the training of other swindlers." And that's what they've used it for. It's basically a hole in the wall, a safe house.
Absolutely. Adolf Hitler knew all about what Palestine was going to be used for. He was concerning Palestine. He was a prophet. It's too bad he wasn't a prophet concerning the amount of Jewish control that he didn't count on that the Jews actually had over England and America.
Absolutely.
But concerning Palestine, he knew exactly what was going on.
You crack open a newspaper and hear about some CEO who's been indicted. The next thing you hear, he's fled to Israel, and now they can't touch him.
No doubt, and spies and Israel won't extradite Jews to non-Jewish to non-Jewish countries. They won't extradite Jews. If you're a Jew, no matter the crime you commit in a quote unquote Goyim nation, when you get to Palestine, you're safe.
And the truth of the matter is that the whole world is Jewish, though, so it shouldn't matter because there is no such thing as a non-Jewish country today.
Well, absolutely. But they won't. They won't extradite anybody from Kyrgyzstan into any other nation.
They won't allow it to be subject to Goyish justice.
Exactly. That it's in the Talmud. It's a fact of the Talmud that they won't allow that. And they obey their holy book. Christians ignore their own. If Christians practice Christianity, Jews would have zero power and zero influence in Christian lands.
They'd starve to death.
Absolutely. They'd have to leave. They'd have to go back to Arabia and Kazakhstan and Algeria and all those marginal places where they spent most of the Middle Ages, right? I'd like to start reading from Mein Kampf, and I have several quotes here. I have actually about 8 pages of quotes here, I think, from Adolf Hitler to demonstrate that internationalism is Jewish. It was Jewish in the 19th century. It was the plot all along of the Jewish capitalists and the Jewish Marxists who worked in concert to achieve the breaking down of the barriers of all nations. And once we realize this, and once we realize that Hitler knew this, well, we will know that Hitler even made the assertion concerning World War I that it was fought to defend Germany from this alien influence. And we'll see that Adolf Hitler's cause was the same cause as that of the modern and true American patriot. It's the same cause. It's the same cause that Lindbergh had. It's the same cause that Henry Ford and the entire America First Committee had. It's the same cause that most true Christian identity adherents have today. It is the cessation that the stand against the internationalization and Judaization of the entire world.
All right, so where should we begin the reading?
Well, I have from Mein Kampf pages 215 to 216, and yes, I'm going to bounce around a little bit, right? The assumption that all races are alike leads to the assumption that nations and individuals are equal to one another, and international Marxism is nothing but the application effected by the Jew Karl Marx of a general conception of life to a definite profession of political faith. But in reality, that general concept had existed long before the time of Karl Marx. Right, it's right from the pages of the Talmud, right? If it had not already existed as a widely diffused infection, the amazing political progress of the Marxist teaching would never have been possible. In reality, what distinguished Karl Marx from the millions who were affected in the same way was that, in a world already in a state of gradual decomposition, he used his keen powers of prognosis to detect the essential positions so as to extract them and concentrate them with the art of a necromancer in a solution which would bring about the rapid destruction of the independent nations on the globe. But all this was done in the service of his race, meaning the Jews. Marxism acts as a disintegrating solvent. The folkish belief holds that humanity must have its ideals because ideals are a necessary condition of human existence itself. But on the other hand, it denies that an ethical ideal has the right to prevail if it endangers the existence of a race that is the standard bearer of a higher ideal. For in a world which would be composed of mongrels and negroids, all ideals of human beauty and nobility and all hopes of an idealized future for our humanity would be lost forever. On this planet of ours, human culture and civilization are indissolubly bound up with the presence of the Aryan. If he should be exterminated or subjugated, then the dark shroud of a new barbarian era would enfold the earth. To undermine the existence of human culture by exterminating its founders and custodians, meaning the Aryans, would be an execrable crime in the eyes of those who believe that the folk idea lies at the basis of human existence. Whoever would dare to raise a profane hand against that highest image of God, meaning the Aryans, because Adolf Hitler understood that the Adamic man was an Aryan man and not a Jew.
We're the custodians. He understood
exactly.
The dominion.
Whoever would dare to raise a profane hand against that highest image of God among his creatures would sin against the bountiful creator of this marvel and would collaborate in the expulsion from paradise. Hitler was a Christian that understood that the Aryan white man was the pinnacle of Yahweh's creation, Genesis 1, chapters 26 through 28, and Genesis 2, 7. And I would say that Hitler also understood, and this fully reveals that he understood, that the end game of the Jew was to exterminate the white race. That's what he's talking about here.
Let's read back to Genesis 3:15.
Exactly, and everybody that tries to claim that Hitler was a Rothschild agent, Hitler was a Jew, well, first, obviously, they've never read Mein Kampf. A Jew would never print this. A Jew could never understand it. And besides that, those people that claim that Hitler was a Jew or Hitler was a Rothschild agent, they're playing right into the hands of the Jews and Rothschild agents. They're playing Rothschild agent themselves.
So if somebody's a generic nationalist who doesn't like Hitler, they'll say, oh, Hitler was an evil, nasty German. But if they're in tune to the Jews and they understand what the Jews are about, they'll say, oh, Hitler was a Jew. Don't listen to anything Hitler had to say. The fact is, if Hitler had been a Jew, Mein Kampf would read like some trashy romance novel, wouldn't it? It would be full of homosexuality and other filth.
Well, right. If Hitler had been a Jew, Mein Kampf, my struggle, would have meant his struggle to conquer all the Germanic women in Berlin or something, or in Munich. Wilhelm Marr already foresaw the demise of the German people because he, meaning Wilhelm Marr, had no faith that anyone could possibly revive any spirit of race or nationhood or kinship among them. And in the face of the already readily apparent Judaization of Germany, all the way back to 1870, right? And Hitler saw the possibility that through the appeal to the folkish idea, that spirit could be revived. And Hitler was successful at it. And even though his success was defeated by the international Jew, Germany stood up for itself. And that was a lot better than the voluntary submission of Britain and America to Jewish slavery, which is what we've done.
If Hitler had been a Jew, the German nation would have been probably dissolved into several provinces for the Soviet Union, and Soviet tanks would have been in Iceland someday.
Well, right. It would have been split. If Hitler was a Jew, Germany would have had a central bank, and the Jews would have ran Germany. And Hitler could have had his little tin army in Bavaria or in the Rhineland or wherever he wanted, and the Jews would have sufficed and humored him if he were a Jew. And that's exactly what would have happened. Because even the Jews, you know, like economy, right? That they're always out to save a penny. Well, why have a war if you could take over a nation like America without a war? And that's exactly what they've done here. Yet, you know, Hitler went on to say in these pages that the concept of the world is in profound accord with nature's will because it restores the free play of the forces which will lead the race through stages of sustained reciprocal education towards a higher type until finally the best portion of mankind will possess the earth and will be free to work in every domain all over the world and even reach spheres that lie outside the earth. And I would say that is not this folk concept the very foundation of the biblical covenants between Yahweh and the real people of Israel, not the Jews.
Modern mainstream Judeo-Christianity Christians, they think the meek, as in the weak, the pathetic, the petty, the useless, are going to inherit the earth, when it really means meek in spirit, those who are humble before God and their brothers.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what it means. And meek does not equal weak and useless and crippled and mongrelized and broken. That's not meek at all.
They seem to think it means the starving Haitian children are going to inherit the earth.
Well, the Jews have basically taken the biblical covenants between Yahweh and true Israel, claimed them for themselves, and perverted them. And this is why Christ told the Edomites that they have taken the key of knowledge and do not enter in themselves, and prohibit those who are entering in. That's exactly what the Jews do. Hitler said on page 216 of Mein Kampf that, quote, only when the international idea politically organized by Marxism is confronted by the folk idea, equally well organized in a systematic way and equally well led, only then will the fighting energy in the one camp be able to meet that of the other on an equal footing, and victory will be found on the side of eternal truth. And this is precisely why in all the Jew media, the ideas of Christianity and nationalism are consistently met with the most vehement resistance. And if Hitler was a Jew, he would have never pushed nationalism. This is why also why Christians are called fascists by Jews. And Christians are called fascists by Jews today on the streets of New York and on the streets of Palestine. The Jews know that European fascism was a reaction to internationalism, both communist and capitalist internationalism, and also that the fascist nation of Germany was based upon Christian principles, which are fundamentally opposed to everything which the Jewish heart lusts after.
And the Jews know, too, that if we practice true Christianity, this would essentially be a fascist society, and they would not be welcome.
Well, absolutely, and I'm going to talk about fascism soon here. I'd like to quote a lengthy quote from page 89 of Mein Kampf, where Adolf Hitler actually reveals the commercial nature of the English Empire and how it forced itself onto its members, and what the cost of that endeavor was to England. The chatter about the peaceful conquest of the world by commercial means was probably the most nonsensical stuff ever raised to the dignity of a guiding principle in the policy of a state. Now isn't this is the same rhetoric that we heard in American newspapers all throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and probably still today. And I've read it in the pages of the Wall Street Journal that we would conquer the world by world commerce.
Pepsi that, and Coca-Cola and Nike.
Well, right, and that's the Jewish attitude. And here we see that Hitler understood that in England and in Germany in 100 years ago, right? This nonsense became even more foolish when England was pointed out as a typical example to prove how the thing could be put into practice. Our doctrinal way of regarding history and our professorial ideas in that domain have done irreparable harm and offer a striking proof of how people learn history without understanding anything of it. As a matter of fact, England ought to have been looked upon as a convincing argument against the theory of Pacific conquest of the world by commercial means. No nation prepared the way for its commercial conquests more brutally than England did by means of the sword, and no other nation has defended such conquests more ruthlessly. Is it not a characteristic quality of British statecraft that it knows how to use political power in order to gain economic advantages, and inversely, to turn economic conquests into political power? What an astounding error it was to believe that England would not have the courage to give its own blood for the purposes of its own economic expansion. The fact that England did not possess a national army proved nothing, for it is not the actual military structure of the moment that matters, but rather the will and determination to use whatever military strength is available. England has always had the armament which she needed. She always fought with those weapons which were necessary for success. She sent mercenary troops to fight as long as mercenary sufficed, but she never hesitated to draw deeply and heavily from the best blood of the whole nation when victory could be obtained only by such a sacrifice. And in every case, the fighting spirit, dogged determination, and use of brutal means in conducting military operations have always remained the same. And that's exactly how the English Empire was built, in favor of the Jewish capitalists at the expense of the best blood of England.
Absolutely. They were propping up commercial interests. If you think about it, all of North America, the Indies, Asia, they were all colonized by private corporate entities. the West.
Well, right, the Hudson Bay Company, the Virginia Company, it was all for corporate profit. The East Indies Company, well, that was a Dutch company, I think, the East India Company originally, wasn't it? But all of England was, they sold shares and raised money through the selling of shares to found these colonies and use the world for profit. That's exactly what they did.
Absolutely. And if it was a Dutch company, that means it was probably controlled by Jews in Amsterdam.
And many good white men died on the plains of Afghanistan or in the opium wars so that the Jews could sell opium to the Chinese or however. It's always the international Jew that was the benefactor and the Englishman or the German that paid the price in blood.
The Sassoon family from Baghdad went into India, set up poppy production with poppy plantations, processed it into opium, and then they shipped it to China. When the Chinese rose up against it and said, "We don't want you poisoning our population," the Sassoons used their influence and agitated for war and got the British to go to war to force opium on the Chinese population.
Well, there's no doubt. Yet we don't see that the buzzword cries for globalism came from, and still do, in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, those cries came from the same sources, the Jewish merchants and the Jewish bankers that were behind the brutal expansion of the English Empire. And we don't see that Korea and Vietnam and even Iraq are mere extensions of the same phenomena. And they certainly are. They are nothing but wars engineered for the advancement of the globalist agenda. International capitalism as well as international communism were both being trumpeted in Germany in the early 19th through the early 20th centuries, just as we have seen here in America. And I'd like to show as much from Mein Kampf, pages 92 to 93.
Just wanted to mention briefly the Berlin Conference. I think it was in, the 1879 or early 1880s, and that was basically the height of folly, wasn't it? The Germans are going to acquire some overseas empire when they really don't need it. There's essentially only a few thousand Germans leaving the homeland, and they're going to become absorbed in places such as Tanzania and Namibia in certain instances because you have millions of native black savages being ruled over by a few thousand Germans, and it's not an extension of Germany. It's just turning Germany into a multiracial empire when before it was a nation state.
Absolutely. Just like imperialism has turned America into a multiracial empire. Just like because of imperialism, the English and the Dutch today are being swamped with the third world heathens from the nations that they at one time subdued.
I mean,
that they had one time subjected.
Say, look at Estonia and Switzerland. They had no colonies, and they're faring the storm pretty well compared to what's going on in France, for instance.
Well, absolutely. France is being overrun by Algerians and Arabs, where France once had colonies. To quote Adolf Hitler, pages 92 and 93, Mein Kampf, "If we would look for the deeper grounds which made it possible to foist on the people this absurd notion of peacefully conquering the world through commercial penetration," which you were just explaining with German colonies, right? "And how it was possible to put forward the maintenance of world peace as a national aim." We hear that all the time in globalist propaganda today. "We shall find that these grounds lay in a general morbid condition that had pervaded the whole body of German political thought." And we have that today. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you practice this globalist one-world commercial religion. "The international Jew, his politics and his media, puts all the burden of responsibility for a national economy on the state." So we see that the problem we have here was the problem that Germany had 100 years ago, and this is going to get pretty good. "This serves to squeeze us into the communist capitalist paradigm. In reality, the government should have little to do with an economy, and that was one of the principal foundations of our American nation." This is from Mein Kampf, page 95. Quote, "A state has never arisen from commercial causes for the purpose of peacefully serving commercial ends. But states have always arisen from the instinct to maintain the racial group. Whether this instinct manifested itself in the heroic spear or in the spear of cunning and chicanery. In the first case, meaning the heroic spear, we have the Aryan states, based on the principles of work and cultural development. In the second case, talking about the spear of cunning and chicanery, we have the Jewish parasitic colonies. But as soon as economic interests began to predominate over the racial and cultural instincts in a people or state, these economic interests unloose the causes that lead to subjugation and oppression, unquote. And I would say that we have seen since the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, when the Jew came to control our economy, and we saw Wilhelm Marr said that the Jew controlled their economy since 1879, right? Well, since 1913, we have seen that economic interests have dominated our culture. When the Jew came to control the economy, economic interests came to control our culture and have caused the subjugation and oppression that now rule over America. No man can serve two masters, God and Mammon. The American people, especially in voting three times for Franklin Roosevelt, right? They chose Mammon, and therefore we have tyranny and oppression. It's the natural outcome of choosing Mammon is tyranny and oppression.
Absolutely. May I read briefly from page 63?
Be my guest.
The authority of the state can never be an end in itself, for if that were so, any kind of tyranny would be inviolable and sacred. If a government uses the instruments of power in its hands for the purpose of leading a people to ruin, then rebellion is not only the right but also the duty of every individual citizen. The question of whether and when such a situation exists cannot be answered by theoretical dissertations but only by the exercise of force, and it is success that decides the issue. It sounds to me like his name would have been on the Declaration of Independence had he been alive in 1776.
Well, absolutely, and Thomas Jefferson said that government rules by the consent of the governed. Today, government rules by the consent of the damn Jews on Wall Street, and that's the people chose that. Hitler saw the real plans of the Jews in global commercialism, and I'd like to read, go on.
I just wanted to say he would make a better American patriot than most Americans today that style themselves patriots and Tea Partiers.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt. The Tea Partiers, most of them are still deceived. They're looking at least, but they're still deceived. And Hitler saw the real plans of the Jews in global commercialism. I'd like to read from Mein Kampf, pages 96 to 97, where he talks mainly of the 19th century. Quote, "During the boisterous years of my youth, nothing used to damp my wild spirit so much as to think that I was born at a time when the world had manifestly decided not to erect any more temples of fame except in honor of business people and state officials. The tempest of historical achievements seemed to have permanently subsided, so much so that the future appeared to be irrevocably delivered over to what was called peaceful competition between the nations." And we've heard that's a buzzword from the 50s, right? We've heard that since the end of World War II here in America.
Coexistence. There is no such thing.
Well, right, and we're competing with the Japanese when they flood our markets with cheap cars. We're competing with the Chinese when they flood our markets with cheap steel and all our steel mills close down because they can't possibly make steel that damn cheap.
Why compete with them? Why not just shut them out and say we're done with you?
Well, that's what should have happened, and that's what Hitler's talking about. This simply meant a system of mutual exploitation by fraudulent means. He knew exactly what it was about. The principle of resorting to the use of force in self-defense being formally excluded. That's what we've done. China can flood our markets with garbage. We have no more self-defense. It's been excluded. We can't shut them out, right? Because we signed all these treaties, right?
When the Jews declared war on Germany in 1933 in the British Daily Express, I believe it was, the March 22nd or 23rd issue, it said Judea declares war on Germany, and they were calling on all the Jews across the world to use economic, political, and diplomatic leverage to ruin Germany and drive her back into the Stone Age, basically, and then right after that, millions of Jews rallied around the world. Is it wrong to respond to that sort of war with military force?
Well, right. And let's go back to Hitler talking about that sort of war, right? Talking about the global commercial system. Individual countries increasingly assumed the appearance of commercial undertakings. That's what China is. It's a commercial undertaking, right? The Red Army owns all the factories. Grabbing territory and clients and concessions from each other under any and every kind of pretext. And it was all staged to an accompaniment of loud but innocuous shouting. This trend of affairs seemed destined to develop steadily and permanently. Having the support of public approbation, it seemed bound eventually to transform the world into a mammoth department store. Isn't that Jewish heaven that he's describing? In the vestibule of this emporium, there would be rows of monumental busts which would confer immortality on those officials who had shown themselves the most innocuous. The salesmen could be represented by the English and the administrative functionaries by the Germans, whereas the Jews would be sacrificed to the unprofitable calling of proprietorship.
And aren't they all entrepreneurs today?
Yeah, right. He's saying the Jews are going to end up owning everything, right? That's what he's saying. For they are constantly avowing that they make no profits, crocodile tears, and are always being called upon to pay out. Moreover, they have the advantage of being versed in the foreign languages. Hitler clearly understood that international capitalism, like international communism, would result in the Jewish domination of all nations.
And they have a natural advantage in business, don't they? Especially international business, where I can't just get on a plane, land in France, and start negotiating in French. I'd have to hire interpreters, translators, and they're not going to respect me as much. But the Jew, he can speak six or seven languages fluently because he's an internationalist.
Well, right. They're internationalists. They're raised learning those languages. That's been bred into them. It's a practice in all their families to learn multiple languages, and they have connections that they have connections through their synagogues all throughout the world that we'll never have because we are not internationalists. When I grew up, my family only cared about one language. We never imagined having to speak anything else but English. I never heard a foreign tongue until I got to high school and took Latin and Spanish. Now, I was amazed that other languages existed.
You never heard jive in the streets of Jersey?
Well, Ebonics or whatever you want to call it, right? Oh, okay. There was evidently a movement in pre-Nazi Germany. This is way before Hitler's time, right? Which was opposed to the usury-based economy. And here Hitler reveals one major inspiration for his later economic policies, and that's the German economist Gottfried Feder. And speaking about the evils of the usury-based state, Hitler stated on page 124 of Mein Kampf that when I heard Gottfried Feder's first lecture on the abolition of interest servitude, I understood immediately that here was a truth of transcendental importance for the future of the German people. The absolute separation of stock exchange capital from the economic life of the nation would make it possible to oppose the process of internationalization in German business without at the same time attacking capital as such, for to do this would be to jeopardize the foundations of our national independence. I clearly saw what was developing in Germany, and I realized then that the stiffest fight we would have to wage would not be against the enemy nations, but against the international capital. In Feder's speech, I found an effective rallying cry for our coming struggle. Here again, later events proved how correct was the impression we had then. The fools among our bourgeois politicians do not mock at us on this point anymore. For even those politicians now see, if they would speak the truth, that international stock exchange capital was not only the chief instigating factor in bringing on the war, but that now when the war, meaning World War One, is over, it turns the peace into a hell. The struggle against international finance capital and loan capital has become one of the most important points in the program on which the German nation has based its fight for economic freedom and independence. And in that statement, we see that Adolf Hitler professed that World War One was indeed a fight against the Rothschilds and against their co-conspirators. And I would assert that the people who insist that Hitler was a Rothschild, those people are working for the Rothschilds. That this is the same struggle. Hitler realized the Judaization of Germany had been enabled because of international capital and the Jews' control of a usury-based economy.
Look at the clowns that say Hitler was working to build a New World Order and he was a Rothschild agent. They're mostly the Alex Jones types, and they never name the Jew. They say Arabs own the media, it's the British Anglo banking cartel. They'll never name the Jew, so of course they're going to attack people who do name the Jew.
Well, absolutely. And when Christian identists fall for the Hitler was a Jew garbage, that they're the biggest fools because they should know better. They're the ones that should know better. And white nationalists, too. White nationalists are right there with them. They should know better. They should actually read Mein Kampf if they're white nationalists. And they might learn better if they could possibly understand it, right? I mean, for a lot of the white nationalists, non-Christian white nationalists, I know six-letter words are hard. Hitler's discourse from pages at 134 through 136 of Mein Kampf, it is, I think, quite brilliant. And it also fits, much of it fits exactly the situation in America in the years since World War II. And I'd like to get into that. And if you want to read from page 134 on my Mein Kampf site, you're more than welcome to. Otherwise,
I have a book
read
in front of me. Do you want me to start?
As long as it's the Murphy edition, yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah, it's not the Garbage Mannheim one.
Well, but it remained for the Jews should be the first word, right?
But it remained for the Jews with their unqualified capacity for falsehood and their fighting comrades, the Marxists, to impute responsibility for the downfall precisely to the man who alone had shown a superhuman will and energy in his effort to prevent the catastrophe which he had foreseen and to save the nation from that hour of complete overthrow and shame. By placing responsibility for the loss of the World War on the shoulders of Ludendorff, they took away the weapon of moral right from the only adversary dangerous enough to be likely to succeed in bringing the betrayers of the fatherland to justice. All of this was inspired by the principle, which is quite true in itself, that in the big lie, there is always a certain force of credibility because the broad masses of a nation are always more easily corrupted in the deeper strata of their emotional nature than consciously or voluntarily, and thus in the primitive simplicity of their minds, they more readily fall victims to the big lie than the small lie. And people always misquote Hitler and take this out of context. They quote him here to make it sound like he's talking about how to get away with lying. But he's
well, right.
To watch out for liars.
And maybe maybe I'll find that passage on the big lie and the Jew and quote that tonight.
Since they themselves often tell small lies and little matters, but would be ashamed to resort to large-scale falsehoods. And this, again, shows that Hitler understands Scripture. He knows that the white people are very trusting, and they can't conceive that a people as wicked as the Jew could possibly exist. It would never come into their heads to fabricate colossal untruths, and they would not believe that others could have the impudence to distort the truth so infamously. Even though the facts which prove this to be so may be brought clearly to their minds, they will still doubt and waver and will continue to think that there may be some other explanation. For the grossly impudent lie always leaves traces behind it, even after it has been nailed down, a fact which is known to all expert liars in this world and to all who conspire together in the art of lying. And, of course, he's talking about Jews primarily.
Right, and I'm confused. This is the passage I meant on the big lie. That's it. He explains that the Jews, that they're so brazenly bold that they'll tell any lie, and Germans or white people in general can't understand that anybody would lie so brazenly, and so we believe it.
These people know only too well how to use falsehood for the basest purposes. Well, no one could conceive that I might come in a room when the sun's out high in the sky and tell you that the sky is turquoise. You would think, right.
And that's another thing Christians don't understand, and that's because they don't read their Bibles. Christ told the Jews in the temple and in Jerusalem that you are of your father the devil. The work of your father he would do. He was a liar and a murderer from the beginning.
And he abode not in the truth.
Exactly. He abode not in the truth. And that's if Christians would read their Bibles, they'd understand that when a Jew moves his lips, he's lying. It's that easy. John the Apostle in his epistle says, who was a liar but those who deny that Jesus is the Christ? They're liars. They're all liars. They lie about that. They lie about anything. They lie about everything. Now this Ludendorff, he was actually a war hero. He was the victor at the Battle of Tannenberg, which was a famous battle. And from August 1916, he was appointed the general quartermaster, which made him the joint head of Germany's war effort, right? And he was really the de facto head of the war effort until his resignation in October 1918. Now, Ludendorff was not responsible. As we could read in many places in the pages of Mein Kampf, Hitler explained fully that the war effort failed at first because the German Jewish munitions manufacturers, the people that controlled the supply lines, were Jews, and they caused labor strikes that sold out the German war effort and severely hampered the Kaiser's ability to execute the war.
Right at the crucial moment in the 1918 Kaiserslautern spring offensive, they said the German army was advancing so rapidly they were outstripping their supply lines and units were running out of ammunition and there was no ammo in the rear areas to be sent to them. They were just
right.
The supply depots were all depleted.
And Hitler explained it. That was a purposeful ploy by the Jews in Germany, and they cost Germany the war. And Hitler stated that many times in Mein Kampf. But the Jewish media, the Jewish-controlled media, because the Jews controlled the media during World War I in Germany, and we learned that from Wilhelm Marr, that they controlled the media in the 1870s, right? And they blamed Ludendorff for the war. And I would say that you know, it's absolutely manifest that the person the Jews are denigrating, he's the person we should be venerating. And the person, the people that the Jews venerate, they're the people that we should hold of no regard.
Well, how could Ludendorff have cost them the war? He had no sway over the workers. He couldn't tell them don't strike.
Well, absolutely. He was basically he was a war hero in the past, but in this capacity, he's basically just a bureaucrat, right?
He was simply allocating the supplies that got sent to his logistics units, and nothing was sent because all the workers were inspired by the Jews to go strike at the crucial moment.
No doubt.
From time immemorial, however, the Jews have known better than any others how falsehood and calumny can be exploited. Is not their very existence founded on one great lie, namely that they are a religious community, whereas in reality they are a race? And what a race! One of the greatest thinkers that mankind has produced has branded the Jews for all time with a statement which is profoundly and exactly true. He, Schopenhauer, called the Jew the great master of lies. Well, of course, they come from Satan, the father of all lies, John 8:44.
Right. And let me say that Schopenhauer was a 19th century German philosopher. I think he died around 1860. And his work promoted the ascetic lifestyle, abstinence from lust, abstinence from temporal pleasures, and things that the Jew would never understand, right? The Jew could never understand that. And basically, Hitler quotes Schopenhauer very often in his writing, and that shows that even Hitler's sources were anti-devils, right?
Absolutely, and of course, if someone promotes that sort of lifestyle, he's ultimately going to come into contact with Jews, in conflict with them.
Well, right, he's going to come into conflict with them because the Jews are the world's primary purveyors of lust and physical enticement, right?
How did they attack
Schopenhauer? They're the panderers of the world. The Jews are the panderers of the world. The Jews are the whoremasters. The Jews are 99% of our pornographers are Jews. All these magazines that promote worship of the beast, that they're all produced by Jews.
And how did the Jews attack Schopenhauer? They started a Schopenhauer group and claimed that they were Schopenhauer, that they represented him.
Yeah, right. Eli says the way the Jews attack Schopenhauer is to be establishing a Schopenhauer society. That's the way the Jews destroy people. If they can't beat you head on, they embrace you and pretend to love you and destroy you that way.
And that's how they're trying to destroy identity. If they can't attack us head on, and they can't, they go off and they start some church in Kentucky, some church in Missouri, some church wherever, you name it, they'll start some false flag church.
Absolutely. And just do everything they can to destroy identity. They do it all the time.
He, Schopenhauer, called the Jew the great master of lies.
Well, you know, that's right from Jesus Christ, right? That comes right from the New Testament. Schopenhauer must have been a Christian, too.
He must have actually read his Bible.
Yes, he must have.
Those who do not realize the truth of that statement or do not wish to believe it will never be able to lend a hand in helping truth to prevail. And notice Hitler capitalized truth. And truth in that instance could be synonymous with the word of God or God, since God is truth. And if people don't understand the Jew is the great master of lies, they can't be of any help to God, can they?
None whatsoever. They've embraced the Jew. Christians have embraced the Jew, and they do the work of the devil.
We may regard it as a great stroke of fortune for the German nation that its period of lingering suffering was so suddenly curtailed and transformed into such a terrible catastrophe. For if things had gone on as they were, the nation would have more slowly but more surely gone to ruin. And that's what's happened in this country over the last 8 decades. It hasn't been one huge upheaval. It's been a slow decline into worthlessness. The disease would have become chronic, whereas in the acute form of the disaster, it at least showed itself clearly to the eyes of a considerable number of observers. It was not by accident that man conquered the Black Plague more easily than he conquered tuberculosis. The first appeared in terrifying waves of death that shook the whole of mankind. The other advances insidiously. The first induces terror, the other gradual indifference. And we're seeing that with the war being waged against the white man, particularly in South Africa, where 3 people maybe in a neighborhood of 100 get killed and they write it off as crime. Well, that's just murder. Thank God it didn't happen to me. Too bad that my coworker and my cousin were killed. But if the blacks came openly shouting and screaming for blood and they tried to massacre the whole neighborhood in one night, the white man would recognize it as a war and respond accordingly. That's really one of our great tragic flaws, isn't it? We don't recognize a gradual, subtle attack. We don't see it for what it is. We're just glad it didn't happen to us.
Well, absolutely. And that's exactly what he's saying here. And the Jew has infested our nation a little at a time and perverted our values a little at a time and eradicated our culture a little at a time. And when he's done after 100 years, you have a different nation, different values, and different culture that are absolutely unrecognizable from what you had 100 years ago.
Absolutely. So it doesn't matter if he does it with a Bolshevik revolution or a 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s cultural war.
And that's exactly what happened here.
The end result is Bolshevism in the USA.
No doubt.
The result is, however, that men opposed the first with all the energy they were capable of whilst they tried to arrest tuberculosis by feeble means. Thus, man has mastered the Black Plague while tuberculosis still gets the better of him. The same applies to diseases in nations. So long as these diseases are not of a catastrophic character, the population will slowly accustom itself to them and later succumb. It is then a stroke of luck, although a bitter one, when fate decides to interfere in this slow process of decay and suddenly brings the victim face to face with the final stage of the disease. More often than not, the result of a catastrophe is that a cure is at once undertaken and carried through with rigid determination. But even in such a case, the essential preliminary condition is always the recognition of the internal causes which have given rise to the disease in question. So basically, the Mexicans can continue flooding across our southern border a few million a year, but if 100 million of them came in tomorrow screaming, La Raza, kill the white man, we're taking back North America, we'd recognize it as the war that it actually is. But that's not going to happen. The important question here is the differentiation of the root causes from the circumstances developing out of them. This becomes all the more difficult the longer the germs of disease remain in the national body and the longer they are allowed to become an integral part of that body. It may easily happen that as time goes on, it will become so difficult to recognize certain definite virulent poisons as such that they are accepted as belonging to the national being. Just like today they say America was built on diversity, the hell it was. They say diversity is our strength. We can't even recognize that it's our weakness.
Exactly. It's a huge weakness.
Or they
it's
are merely
cancer.
Or they are merely tolerated as a necessary evil. How many people say interest is a necessary evil? Without interest, our economy would grind to a halt. Without the Federal Reserve, we'd all be in the poorhouse. Well, how did we make it for the first 150 years? How did we make it? We were just blind men groping. Is that what they'd have us believe? Or they are merely tolerated as a necessary evil so that drastic attempts to locate those alien germs are not held to be necessary. During the long period of peace prior to the last war, certain evils were apparent here and there, although with one or two exceptions, very little effort was made to discover their origin. Here again, these exceptions were first and foremost those phenomena in the economic life of the nation which were more apparent to the individual than the evil conditions existing in a good many other spheres. There were many signs of decay which ought to have been given serious thought. As far as economics were concerned, the following may be said. The amazing increase of population in Germany before the war brought the question of providing daily bread into a more and more prominent position in all spheres of political and economic thought and action. But unfortunately, those responsible could not make up their minds to arrive at the only correct solution and preferred to reach their objective by cheaper methods. Repudiation of the idea of acquiring fresh territory and the substitution for it of the mad desire for the commercial conquest of the world was bound to lead eventually to unlimited and injurious industrialization. Not to mention it's bound to lead with conflict with Britain, since Britain was already pursuing that policy of commercial conquest of the world.
Well, there actually was a conflict there that few people really know about, was that Germany was going to build, German industrialists were going to build a railroad from Germany to Istanbul and across Turkey, and that way they could have access to the East, trade with the East, without having to go run ships by England or through the Suez Canal.
And the British don't want that, of course.
And that would have avoided the British sea monopoly, right? And that would have caused big problems, yes. And the British wanted to stop that.
Not to mention the British wanted a railroad from Cape to Cairo. And the fact that the Germans had Tanzania, and prior to the Second Anglo-Boer War, the Boers had their republics of the Orange Free State and Transvaal. That was an obstacle. And of course, the Boers felt affinity with the Germans, and the Germans helped the Boers to an extent. But what could the Boers do alone against the English Rothschild Jewish Empire? Supposedly, the British Empire, I don't want to go too far off, I just want to say, supposedly it existed to support and spread white supremacy, but they clobbered and brutalized the Boers. So we've seen the ugliness with which the British Empire would conduct itself when gold and diamonds were involved. I mean, honestly, can we believe that Anglo-Saxon Britons would massacre Boer women and children for diamonds and gold? It was certainly a Jewish operation from day one.
Well, of course it was.
The first and most fatal result brought about in this way was the weakening of the agricultural classes, whose decline was proportionate to the increase in the proletariat of the urban areas, until finally the equilibrium was completely upset. The big barrier dividing rich and poor now became apparent. Luxury and poverty lived so close to each other that the consequences were bound to be deplorable. Want and frequent unemployment began to play havoc with the people and left discontent and embitterment behind them. The result of this was to divide the population into political classes. Discontent increased in spite of commercial prosperity. Matters finally reached that stage which brought about the general conviction that things cannot go on as they are, although no one seemed able to visualize what was really going to happen.
Now, isn't that the same? That's the same situation we've had in the United States the last 50 years. It's the same exact situation.
Absolutely. People say this can't sustain itself. This can't go on, but they don't know how things could go on. They don't know what the alternative could be. They don't know how it's going to play out. They just say it can't go on.
And most people don't know that the economy is really just run on hot air.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely engineered. The Great Depression, that the prosperity of the 1920s was caused when the Jews kept increasing the money supply, and they pulled the rug out from under the money supply and contracted it purposely in 1929, which caused the Great Depression.
Absolutely.
And they kept us in a state of depression purposely until 1941. And when war was declared against Germany, when the Congress went along with that, all of a sudden, all these companies that couldn't hire people weeks before had plenty of money to tool up for a war.
And when our industry was no longer needed because Germany had been laid low and the world had been made safe for communism and the Rothschilds, they began the gradual process of sending our industry overseas.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to say that things can go on indefinitely like this because we're basically in one big confidence trick. As long as we give our confidence to the Federal Reserve note, they can sustain this for 1,000 years. It's a never-ending scam until we decide that we've had enough.
Yes, it is a never-ending scam, or until they decide that they finally want to pull the plug and move to China.
Matters finally reached that stage which brought about the general conviction that things cannot go on as they are, although no one seemed able to visualize what was really going to happen. These were typical and visible signs of the depths which the prevailing discontent had reached. Far worse than these, however, were other consequences which became apparent as a result of the industrialization of the nation. In proportion to the extent that commerce assumed definite control of the state, money became more and more a god whom all had to serve and bow down to. And the Jew knows that no man can have two masters. They don't want us to have God as a master.
Well, absolutely. But our people have worshipped this beast. This is the worship of the beast. Hitler's describing it perfectly, that this is the Babylonian system, and our people have all succumbed, and the government and the economy and money have become their god, period.
As far as God used to have been the center of lives for most Americans and most white people, the Jews have unseated him. They've knocked him off his throne in relation to his position in our life. Of course, he's still the king of the universe, the ruler of everything, but he's gone from having a prominent central role in most people's daily lives to just being somewhere on back burner, if even there. They want us to serve their state-appointed idols.
And that's what we do. That's what our people do.
Heavenly gods became more and more old-fashioned and were laid away in the corners to make room for the worship of mammon. There's that term again, old-fashioned. Where have we heard that? Everything we believe is old-fashioned. We need to get with the times and become progressive.
Or become Jews, right?
Well, didn't you say that the Romans were told to practice perversion because the Jews called it modern and progressive?
Well, actually, it was Tacitus, the historian, who said that they were engaging in all sorts of sexual deviancy and calling it modern.
And it never changes.
No, the same thing that happened in Tacitus's time in 70 AD happened in the 1970s in America, and people fell for it all over again. Oh, it's okay if it's Adam and Steve. That's modern. That's up to date. Get with the times. What are you, old-fashioned? Yeah, well, absolutely.
That kind of sin goes all the way back to 6,000 years ago.
Well, morality should never go out of fashion. That's absolutely ridiculous that moral standards could possibly come in and out of fashion. We change moral standards like we change our the width of the sleeves and of our shirts and the cuffs of our dungarees.
It seems to me that it should be as simple as 2 plus 2 equaled 4 6,000 years ago, and it still equals 4.
Well, that's old-fashioned. Well, we all know that 2 plus 2 equals 5 now. I mean, compound interest works wonders.
And thus began a period of utter degeneration, which became especially pernicious because it set in at a time when the nation was more than ever in need of an exalted idea. for a critical hour was threatening. Germany should have been prepared to protect with the sword her efforts to win her own daily bread in a peaceful way. Unfortunately, the predominance of money received support and sanction in the very quarter which ought to have been opposed to it. His Majesty the Kaiser made a mistake when he raised representatives of the new finance capital to the ranks of the nobility. And this goes back to why the Rothschilds wanted Prussia to unify Germany, so they could have one guy they'd have to corrupt instead of 200 princes. Admittedly, it may be offered as an excuse that even Bismarck failed to realize the threatening danger in this respect. In practice, however, all ideal virtues became secondary considerations to those of money, for it was clear that having once taken this road, the nobility of the sword would very soon rank second to that of finance.
And that's today, America today. That's absolutely America today. Under this Federal Reserve system, we have become the same way that he's describing Germany in the years leading up to World War One.
And isn't it true in America that the war heroes, the people who build businesses out of the ground, the great industrialists, the Carnegies, they're all shoved aside to make way for the money manipulators and the speculators, the Trumps of the world?
Well, right. Donald Trump and Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky and those Jews. Who was that kike that Michael Douglas played in that Wall Street movie?
Gordon Gekko, who said greed is good.
Gordon Gekko, right. There's your hero. Your modern-day hero is Gordon Gekko, who can rip everybody out of the most money with shady business deals. He's the hero. He's the idol of society. And it's been that way since the 1980s, from what I perceive in my life.
All right. Financial operations succeed easier than war operations. Hence, it was no longer any great attraction for a true hero or even a statesman to be brought into touch with the nearest Jew banker. Real merit was not interested in receiving cheap decorations and therefore declined them with thanks. But from the standpoint of good breeding, such a development was deeply regrettable. The nobility began to lose more and more of the racial qualities that were a condition of its very existence, with the result that in many cases the term plebeian would have been more appropriate.
And that happened in ancient Rome, and that happened in Britain, in London with the Jews in the 18th and 19th centuries, right?
Absolutely.
The Jewish merchants hold all the seats of nobility now.
And people were raising the alarm about it, and no one listened to them. Back in the 1880s, 1890s, they said more and more of the British nobles were starting to look like they were Asiatic.
Well, right, but today practically all of them are. They bought their way in, and once enough of them bought their way in, the floodgates were open.
And who are the idols of society today? Who do we laud? Who do we hold up as a model of how you should conduct yourself and what you should aspire to be? We have no room for Robert E. Lee's, or we have no room for Jeb Stuart's or Stonewall Jackson's or Andrew Jackson's or Thomas Jefferson's. We all have to make way for Britney Spears or Paris Hilton or some Jew finance minister.
Oh, Homer Simpson.
Right. Would you like to take over, sir?
A serious state of economic disruption was being brought about by the slow elimination of the personal control of vested interests and the gradual transference of the whole economic structure into the hands of joint stock companies. That's what we have here. We've had it for a long time. In this way, labor became degraded into an object of speculation in the hands of unscrupulous exploiters. The problem with Jewish capitalism, right? The depersonalization of property ownership increased on a vast scale. And what that does, the depersonalization of property ownership, when everything is a security, when everything is owned by the public or virtually so many Jews and so many wealthy people that the company virtually belongs to thousands of people, there's no accountability anymore, right? There's no accountability. That these companies, that they get caught in these great crimes, they pay a fine that's really a pittance to the owners, to the wealth of the owners, and they move on with it. It's incredible.
For instance, there's a particular banker, broker we know who cheated and swindled millions out of a bunch of his elderly clients. didn't do a day in jail, didn't pay a penny. The company itself took the loss, and then he just moved on.
Right.
100 years ago, that wouldn't be possible, or at least we would hope it wouldn't have been possible. But now corporations are persons under the law, and the individual employees, if they commit a crime in the furtherance of the corporate goals, they avoid responsibility.
Well, all sorts of crimes have been committed in the 20th century by Jews in charge of various corporations, and the corporations have paid the fine, and the Jews have walked. And it happens over and over and over again.
Judaism is basically a racketeer-influenced corrupt organization.
That's exactly what it is. And this entire economic system that set up this phony economic system of securities and usury-based money, which is created from nothing, fiat money that demands use, it's all Jewish subterfuge and Jewish smoke and mirrors. Financial exchange circles began to triumph and made slow but sure progress in assuming control of the whole of national life. That's the situation America is in today. Before the war, the internationalization of the German economic structure had already begun by the roundabout way of share issues. It is true that a section of the German industrialists made a determined attempt to avert the danger, but in the end, they gave way before the united attacks of money-grabbing capitalism, which was assisted in this fight by its faithful henchmen in the Marxist movement. Now let me say that when your industry is organic, it is organically owned and controlled, meaning it's owned and controlled by people who have a direct interest in the health of the community, well then your industry is going to care a lot more about the community, right? But when your industry is owned and controlled by aliens from outside of your community, they don't care about your community. They don't care if they close a factory and 500 jobs are shut down or lost so that they could make an extra 10 cents on a pair of shoes by moving the factory to China. They don't care about that.
My dad told me one thing about the soda companies. He said that the switch over from cane sugar to high fructose corn syrup saved them about a penny a can. But of course, it is almost certainly directly led to the obesity epidemic in this country. Since everybody drank soda in the 50s and 60s, cane sugar soda, but we didn't have 40% of the country morbidly obese.
Well, absolutely. And I don't drink soda. I haven't drank soda in 40 years, I swear.
They're just some heartless multinational corporation. They don't care. Just like the steel company, if the steel mill in Kentucky is owned by investors in Japan and Saudi Arabia, what do they care if they decide on a whim to move it to China?
Well, absolutely. That's what I just said, and that's why it's the Jewish economic system of securitizing everything. I mean, they would securitize oxygen if they could, right? They would sell oxygen bonds, and then that they would cut the number of trees purposely to make oxygen scarcer so the price goes up.
Well,
the Jews would do that if they could. I mean, it might be coming.
Well, you might remember, I'm not sure if you do, my dad does, though he remembers when Standard Oil of Ohio, SOHIO, they submitted a patent. They wanted energy rights to the sun. The patent office turned them down, though, and said that they could not claim the sun, but they said that they wanted to charge everybody based on their assessment of how much you were using the sun.
Well, they're trying to, they've securitized the water and the water and resources in the nation by many municipalities and local governments have sold their water resources to private companies.
And they're now talking about putting water meters on private wells to measure how much water you take off your own land.
Right. That's incredible. That's incredible.
And this could have never happened in a healthy, functioning Christian society.
Well, of course not. Water comes from God. Famine, feast and famine come from Yahweh. They come from God. They don't come from Jews. Jews don't do anything to they sure as hell don't grow any food, right?
They're just artificially imposed middlemen. They impose themselves on the natural process.
Yes, they do. Before the war, the internationalization of the German economic structure had already begun by the roundabout way of share issues. It is true that a section of German industrialists made a determined attempt to avert the danger, but in the end they gave way before the united attacks of money-grabbing capitalism, which was assisted in its fight by its faithful henchmen in the Marxist movement. Hitler is telling us that the Marxists, the communists, are working for the capitalists.
Well,
and he goes on, the persistent war against German heavy industries was the visible start of the internationalization of German economic life as envisaged by the Marxists. This, however, could only be brought to a successful conclusion by the victory which Marxism was able to gain in the revolution, meaning of 1871-1872. Hitler is telling us that the Marxists worked for the Rothschilds, and we saw in the pages of Nesta Webster that even Karl Marx was making money in the stock market.
I just like to say that the excesses, the open excesses of Jewish capitalism drive otherwise docile, peaceful, happy workers into the arms of the Jewish Marxists. And that's why Marxism
so that the Jewish capitalists prevail, right, exactly.
They don't want those workers forming their own associations or going into the arms of nationalists.
As I write these words, success is attending the general attack on the German state railways, which are now to be turned over to international capitalists. Thus, international social democracy has once again attained one of its main objectives. The best evidence of how far this commercialization of the German nation was able to go can be plainly seen in the fact that when the war was over, one of the leading captains of German industry and commerce gave it as his opinion that commerce was such was the only force which could put Germany on its feet again. This sort of nonsense was uttered just at the time when France was restoring public education on a humanitarian basis, thus doing away with the idea that national life is dependent on commerce rather than ideal values. The statement which Steens broadcasted to the world at the time caused incredible confusion. It was immediately taken up and has become the leading motto of all those humbugs and babblers, the statesmen whom fate let loose on Germany after the revolution.
And we're told that in America, too, basically, that business is all that matters, that national ideals should be centered around business. Yet we've never had more commerce, and our nation's never been worse off.
Well, absolutely. I think I made my point here, and I'd like to move on to pages 202 and 203 and quote just a couple of lines. The Marxist leaders whose business consisted in deceiving and misleading the public naturally hated most of all a movement whose declared aim was to win over those masses which hitherto had been exclusively at the service of international Marxism and the Jewish and stock exchange parties. Hitler again tells us that the Marxists are working for the Jewish capitalists. And history should show us, looking in hindsight, that there's no doubt that the entire Bolshevik Revolution was only to transfer the wealth of Russia into a form of state capitalism, which the Jews alone benefited from. And when the system fell apart, 10 Jews ended up owning all of Russian industry.
And not to mention the bankers and the finance lords, they were allowed to leave the Russian Empire after the Tsar was overthrown. The Marxists didn't do anything to them.
Absolutely. And global Marxism and global capitalism are bed twins and bed partners, and they've they're just two different arms of the same Talmudic Jew who really seeks to simply take over Christendom.
Well, don't the Jews, they always start a two-sided paradigm, and they always control both sides, Republican, Democrat, communist, capitalist. You have to be one.
Well, there should be no doubt. I'd like to read from Mein Kampf, page 93. This is my final reading for tonight. And I hope that we will see, after I read this, why fascism was necessary. Because fascism, while it's no political system is the ideal political system for us, believe me. But fascism was a response to capitalism and Marxism. It seeks to protect communities and by extension nations from the vultures of Jewish capitalism. From page 93 of Mein Kampf, The triumphant process of technical science in Germany and the marvelous development of German industries and commerce led us to forget that a powerful state had been the necessary prerequisite of that success. On the contrary, certain circles went even so far as to give vent to the theory that the state owed its very existence to these phenomena, that it was, above all, an economic institution and should be constituted in accordance with economic interests. Therefore, it was held, the state was dependent on the economic structure. This condition of things was looked upon and glorified as the soundest and most normal arrangement. Well, that's the idea of the Jew that he's repeating, right? And then he goes on, now the truth is that the state itself has nothing whatsoever to do with any definite economic concept or definite economic development. It does not arise from a compact made between contracting parties within a certain delimited territory for the purpose of serving economic ends. The state is a community of living beings who have kindred physical and spiritual natures organized for the purpose of assuring the conservation of their own kind and to help towards fulfilling those ends which Providence has assigned to that particular race or racial branch. There's no way Hitler could say that and be a Jew. Anybody who thinks Hitler was a Jew is a total moron, to continue quoting. Therein and therein alone lie the purpose and the meaning of a state. Economic activity is one of the many auxiliary means which are necessary for the attainment of those aims. But economic activity is never the origin or purpose of a state, except where a state has been originally founded on a false and unnatural basis. And this alone explains why a state as such does not necessarily need a certain delimited territory as a condition of its establishment. This condition becomes a necessary prerequisite only among those people who would provide and assure subsistence for their kinsfolk through their own industry, which means that they are ready to carry on the struggle for existence by means of their own work. People who can sneak their way like parasites into the human body politic and make others work for them under various pretenses can form a state without possessing any definite delimited territory. This is chiefly applicable to that parasitic nation which, particularly at the present time, preys upon the honest portion of mankind, I mean the Jews. If we understand the statement, and there are many other statements in Mein Kampf which elaborate on this idea, we would understand that the creativity of a people is racial and national, and that only a fascist government protects the creative power and the creative faculties of that people from the parasitical international Jew. The parasitical international Jew sees every state as a commercial enterprise to be pillaged and looted at his will. And he'll go in and he'll use a usury-based system to buy up the intellectual material of a state and ship it all outside of the state, stripping the people of their own creative fruits.
That's what always happens. The Chinaman could never invent the steam engine, the internal combustion engine, or anything like that. They could never invent the advanced robotics and electronics or computer processing equipment that we have invented, yet everything we've invented has been shipped over there.
Right. The Chinese could never get anywhere. They never built a building of more than a couple of stories high. That they've never harnessed electricity. They've never had anywhere near the industrial or intellectual capacity that the West has had in able to invent all of these marvelous things, yet the Jew, through his international capitalism, has bought up all of our assets and shipped them to China. And now the Chinese have all of our technology. And they'll never expand on it with any great steps. They'll never get above what they have from us. However, we're going to evidently keep giving it to them as long as we're under this usury-based economy. Because when one party of people has the license to create money from nothing and loan it at interest to the rest of the people, the inevitable result is that that party ends up owning everything in the community. That's inevitable. And now that's what's going on with the Federal Reserve.
Now they own the world. And it seems that these people, their natural state of being would be to exist as, basically subsistence farmers. I'm not talking about the financiers. I'm talking about the Chinamen. But now that they've obtained all of our technology that they could never come up with on their own, we've basically subsidized their industrialization and their population explosion. Where, 100 years ago in Africa, there might have been 20 million sub-Saharan Africans in the entire continent. Today, there are close to a billion.
Well, absolutely, and that's possible through our technology, right? And now they're about to devour us through our technology. That's the position they're in. And they're flooding into our nations, and we created it. Exactly. And I would just like to say in summary here tonight that it should be well demonstrated that international capitalism and international communism are both two arms of the same beast that were designed to subjugate Christendom into the hands of international Judaism. That's what Adolf Hitler feared. That's what the German people were rallied to stand against in the 1930s and 40s. And that's what we destroyed. And we destroyed it for the Jews. And yes. I hope we feel good about that as Americans, because we did the work of Satan. So, Adolf Hitler stood up for his nation and his race.
We made the world safe for Satan.
Absolutely. And look at it today. And everything that Hitler talked about has the problems in Germany have come true here.
All right, so we'll pick up then next week with part two.
Well, next week the Hitler's declaration of war against America, right?
All right. He gives his reasons for why he had to declare war, how he wanted peace, and how the Masons, the Jews, and the Rosenfelds were putting America into situations that did not concern America. They were forcing themselves into the process of diplomatic negotiations between the nations to bring about a huge conflagration. They wanted a world war.
Absolutely. They absolutely wanted a world war, and the result was that they own the world. That's the result. There's no doubt. Okay. Thank you, and praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Yahweh bless. Thank you.